Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, all the friends, allies, and students scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. John Lash, the navigator, recording once again on January 30th, 2013, and this is part two of the briefing entitled Magical Weapons, which could also be entitled Matangi's Weapons. To begin, I'd like to offer a small correction. I may have referred in the previous talk to the lunar cycle that began on December 14th as being a Matangi shift. It was, of course, a Kurukula shift. That day, December 14th, 2012, was the day of the Sandy Hook event. It was also the first day of a new Dakini shift. The Dakini who came on at that time was Kurukula. The crescent moon was visible, the crescent moon marking or signaling the Dakini on shift was observable on the 15th and 16th of December. It was in the constellation of the Archer, correlated to Kurukula. And in fact, on the 14th of December, when the first crescent moon would have been just detectable, the crescent moon was approaching the planet Mars. Mars was located at that time sort of on the haunches or the hind part of the horse, if you visualize the Archer as a horseman. That is the position that also marks the beginning of the empty space, the 13 degrees of space along the ecliptic separating the Archer and the goatfish. In the empty space, there are no discernible stars. So Mars stood at the edge of the empty space. And on the 14th of December, and then again on the 15th, the crescent moon passed in very close proximity to Mars. This was a signal that the Dakini shift of that time came under Kurukula. Then advancing to January, the crescent moon that marked the next shift was in the constellation of the Manitou on the 14th and 15th of January. And so that signaled Matangi. And we are still currently in the Matangi shift as I speak. And the last day of the current Matangi shift would be the 10th of February. So that's specific intel. That's what you could call astronomical tradecraft for those in the Gaia Navigation Experiment. I would emphasize that once again we're looking at an extraordinary situation in which there is an overlapping and a doubling up of Dakini instructions. So the Kurukula shift followed by the Matangi shift, but in both of these shifts Kali is present. Kali, in fact, stands between those two, and I urge you to continue using that visualization of the three warrior goddesses standing with arms locked on the front line of the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So, and as well, of course, visualizing the three wedges of Kalika warrior parties that are in formation behind them. So with that said, let me pick up immediately the subject of discussion at the end of the last briefing. This concerns the assault of the Archons upon the field of perception of the human animal. Again, I ask you to distinguish with great clarity in your mind and in your mental syntax the difference between seeing and perceiving. You could use that term, grok, the difference between seeing and actually grokking what you see. You can see something and not grok it. When you see and grok at the same time, then your perception is operating in alignment with visual discernment, visual detection. What the archons have been attempting to do for some time now is to fill the field of perception with blind spots or maculae. I don't know how you would pronounce the Latin plural of macula, whether it would be maculae or maculae. In any case, I've used the analogy to the physical act, the horrific act, if I must say so, of strapping down someone, forcing open their eyes, and penetrating their eyes, their actual eyeballs, with a pin. These pinpoint assaults produce blind spots in the field of human perception. Now, I've said that this blinding of the human animal is something the archons want to do in order to achieve their final goal of entrapping humanity in their matrix replication of the natural world. And the point I made, the point that I brought up in the last talk, which requires some really careful consideration, is the role of photography in this process. How does the technology of photographic replication blind the human species? It does indeed. And if you want to put that phenomenon, that danger to our species, into a picture, an historical picture, and if you want to regard it in the continuity of its full development, first, you would consider the invention or introduction of still photography. We'll start there. From there, move on to moving photography, the movies or film, first without sound, then with sound. And then move on from there to where we are today, which is holographic imagery and virtual reality imagery, including the imagery of what you see on your computer screens. Those are, as it were, roughly speaking, three stages in the assault of the archons upon the perception of the human animal. Now, in making this claim, or in asking you to consider this proposition, be certain about one thing. I am not stating, and I do not even wish to imply, that photographic technology and replication is an invention of the archons. It most certainly is not. It's an invention of the human species. And in some respects, it's a wonderful invention. The technology of photography, starting with still photographs, moving on to moving pictures, to film, is a wonderful expression of the ingenuity and technological genius of the Anthropos. The technology in itself is not evil. It is not something that the archons made us do. Oh, the archons made me do it. No, but the archons use this technology of our own genius against us. They can't come up with anything on their own. I've said this 1,000 times. The Gnostics were clear on this point as well, and you will find they stated this point in a number of the cosmological treatises from Nag Hammadi. In those documents, it says clearly that whatever power the archons have, and even the overlord of the archon hive, the demiurge, whatever power that entity has is loaned to it from the intelligence of the Pleromic Eons. So they borrow their consciousness, as it were, their capacities from the Pleromic Eons, and they steal and pervert the capacities of the Anthropos. This is how these extraterrestrial demons operate. So, still photography, let's concentrate on still photography. I want to build the paraphrase of Dakini instruction I'm receiving layer by layer. I want to build it carefully in systematic layers. So let's stay with still photography for a while and see if I can elucidate for you the instruction that I've received since I reached up and took Matangi's gift into my hand. When it was introduced in the middle of the 19th century, and you go and research this a little if you want to, still photography of the daguerreotype system and so forth was applied to certain scenes. Photographs were taken of the natural world, and photographs were also taken of people. So, of course, what comes to mind vividly when I mention this subject is those old daguerreotypes you've seen of the West, say of a Mexican cowboy or some cowboy-type character standing in front of a saloon, or sometimes, because there were studio photographers wandering around the Wild West at that time, sometimes you would see a cowboy dressed up, stiffly posed, standing in front of a prop that represents, say, a cactus or something. And this is done in a studio. It's not done out in nature. They couldn't film out in nature. They couldn't take photographs out in nature as well as they could in a controlled environment. So there is a cowboy or a family, of a frontier family, posing together rather stiffly, and there may be some prop in the photograph. And when we look at these photographs today, when you look at them, I ask you to bear in mind a number of points. Let me offer you a number of observations. First of all, the people in these photographs look stiff, but they're not faking anything. They're not faking. They just look stiff because they've never been photographed before. And it is an unusual and, in some respects, uncomfortable and intimidating experience. They look stiff, and you could say they are posed. But they are not posed, for instance, in the way that a woman in a photograph advertising a Toyota car today is posed. Obviously not. The woman in a photographic ad for a car or anything else is skillfully posed. And the manipulation of the image of that woman and everything else in the photograph has been achieved by a massive effort of people down to the finest detail. Well, this is obviously not the case with these early daguerreotype portraits. When you look at them now, you see it's rather stunning and rather arresting because you see that this is the way these people actually looked. There's no attempt really to disguise them. There's no attempt to fake anything. And of course, let's consider not only the people who allowed themselves to be photographed in that manner, but let's consider the people who were looking at those photographs in the era in which they were taken. If you handed me a photograph, if we're sitting in a saloon together, and you hand me a photograph of your uncle, who's a famous gunfighter in Tombstone, and I see him standing there, not in front of an actual corral gate, but in front of a painting of a corral gate, which was on the wall on a canvas in a studio, I know that it's a painting of a corral gate. I know that it's not real. And so even though the photograph is arranged, even though the photograph has been tampered with, as it were, has been contrived, those who observed such photographs at that time had the faculties of their perception intact, and they could tell And there was, they were not tricked into thinking that the corral gate painted on the canvas behind the cowboy was real. And there was no intention of trickery. It was a conventional device that was used to set up the photograph. The point that I'm making here is that when photography was originally invented, in the early years of its usage, it was used extensively without the intention to fake or trick. Intention is everything. The archons cannot achieve pinpoint assault on our field of perception, thereby producing blind spots, unless the photography through which they operate to produce that blinding contains faked and contrived effects. For instance, if you look at scientific photography, for instance, if you're riffling through a book of exotic butterflies and you see plate after plate of exquisite photographs of exotic butterflies that have not been tampered with or arranged in any way, they could be photographs of dead butterflies that have been preserved, or they could be photographs of live butterflies in nature. In either case, the photograph does not wish to deceive or trick you in any way. Inherent to the photograph, there is no intention to deceive you or to lure or entrap you in any manner. The purpose of the photograph is simply to present an accurate replication of what exists in nature so that when you go look at the same thing in nature, you can confirm your perception. You can enhance and sharpen your perception. You can recognize a certain species of butterfly in nature because you have identified that species in a photograph. So, the pinpoint impact or the pinpoint assault on our perception by the archons cannot be achieved through that kind of photography. Real life, still life photography is valuable and helpful. It is a tool of learning, and in the hands of the great black and white photographers of the early 20th century, whom I have studied and whom I really enjoy, it can be a splendid tool to sharpen and enhance human perception. But of course, that kind of photography does not account for the great, great, great majority of still photos that you have seen in your life. In the course of one day in the world today, a human animal living in a city will see hundreds and hundreds of still photographs. Magazine covers of books lined along a shelf at the magazine stand, posters for films, advertising posters, posters on buses, photographs in the windows of shops advertising clothes, photographs of models modeling clothes. Now there's a good example. Here's a good example of the difference to be discerned with a Matangi eye. I could stand in front of a store window and look at a life-size photograph of a woman. If that photograph were taken with the intent merely to replicate as accurately as possible, with no contrivance or distortion, and with no intention to deceive the physical appearance of that woman, then I could look at that photograph and not be subject to a macula. However, if, as most often happens, I am standing in front of a store window looking at a life-size photograph of a woman wearing clothes, a woman posed, a model posed, with an outfit for sale, I most certainly will be impacted and receive a macula, because the latter type of photograph is a complete fake. Why is the woman even being photographed? She's photographed because she's being paid to play a trick on the viewer, and she is party to a team effort to deceive the viewer of the photograph and to lure and entrap people into consumerism. Everything about the model in the photograph is fake. Her makeup, the way her hair hangs off her shoulder, the way the costume is on her body, everything about the costume, everything about the way her hands are held, the gestures of her hands, every single thing in the content of that photograph is faked and posed. And such photographs present a tremendous opportunity for archons to deliver a pinpoint assault on your perception. Therefore, do not look at such photographs ever, ever again, if you can. Or, let me add this. If you choose to look at such photographs, then do so consciously. Bring the Matangi eye to your observation. You can actually restore your perception and heal the massive field of macula that has been inflicted upon you by this archontic assault. You can actually do that by a conscious act of observation. So when you look at any photograph, any still photograph of any kind, make an exercise of observation out of it. And stop and look at it and systematically observe how it has been faked and how it has been contrived and organized with the use of manipulation, organized by manipulation, in order to insinuate an intention into your subconscious. And look at it and register what that intention is that it wishes to insinuate in you. And just observe what happens when you expose yourself to the act of looking at such a photograph. So you don't have to avoid it. I think it's healthy to avoid looking at any kind of still photography that is not an honest, uncontrived photographic replication without a hidden agenda. If you, as I say, page through a book of antique automobiles, photographs of antique automobiles, the purpose of those photographs is to show you what an antique automobile looked like. There is no other intention than to inform you. That kind of photograph of such content created without a hidden agenda to persuade or influence you in any way is fine. It will not damage your perception. Well, needless to say, the kind of photographs that we see are not in that category. And the human species has been, for well over 150 years now, under a massive assault of these pinpoint stabs into the field of perception. Really the equivalent of stabbing a needle into someone's physical eye with the ultimate aim of blinding them completely. This is dangerous stuff I'm talking about. And the archons are really dangerous. But why are they so dangerous? Well, it's because in this instance, I think I can illustrate quite readily why and how they become dangerous. They become dangerous when we do not set limits to the technology that we invent. It's not technology itself, it's keeping that technology within human limits. So if we regulated ourselves, as Wilhelm Reich urged the human species to do, if we were self-regulating, then we would have invented and discovered the art of still photography, and we would have used it for all the wonderful things that it can be used for, both black and white and color photography, though less so color, because color photography tends to be much more manipulated technically and even chemically than black and white. Black and white is more honest than color. But even so, we could have used the technology of still photography for many purposes, to learn, to gather evidence, to preserve evidence, and to study nature. But no, we do not put limits on the use of technology. We allow the fascination of the tools to run away with us, to carry us away. And it is when we do that and we slip beyond the limits that are appropriate for the use of any specific technology that the Archons jump on the bandwagon. And they exploit that weakness that we have. They exploit our failure to set limits with technology. And as a result, technology extrapolates to parameters that are beyond any real use or benefit to the human race. And technology rapidly becomes insane and inhumane. And this is what has happened largely with photographic technology in our time. So don't blame the invention of technology on the Archons, and don't even blame the misuse of it on them. The misuse of it due to setting proper boundaries is our error. And what they do is they jump on our error, they piggyback on our error, and they extrapolate that error beyond the scale of correction. This is how they operate. Obviously, photography was a great boon to them. It has allowed them in the last 150 or so years to install their virtual reality simulation systems in our world. It is photography is a technology that serves as a platform for them to mount HAL into our world, into the human world, and into all the structures of culture. So now when you walk around a city such as Tokyo or London, what do you see? You see all of these images being flashed at you, electronic images now. That's another thing we can get into. What is the difference between a photograph in a book or a photograph on a piece of paper and a still image that is projected by an electronic media? Could get into that, and I'll get into that in a moment. But back to my point, when you walk around now in any city in the United States, in any of the urban areas, and most people do live in the urban areas, you are absolutely assaulted on all sides by imagery that actually displaces you out of the natural world. It takes you away from the sense of living on this planet and relocates you in an artificial environment, in a matrix, where you are inundated with images which in turn are charged with intentions and suggestions based on a hidden agenda. And no human animal can be free living in that kind of maze. So what you see as well in these great cities such as London is not only the archonic technology and the archonic substitutions that have been mounted on the platform of photography, that is to say, the technology of replication, but you also see the human animals who are almost totally blinded by exposure to that technology. I can tell you that I don't go to England anymore, but I've had experiences years ago in London, which I call the City of the Living Dead. And I remember distinctly once that I was walking down Oxford Street, which is sometimes so crowded and jammed with people that it's like being in a jam sandwich. I mean, it's really like being in a sardine box. It's incredible how people will jam themselves together walking down Oxford Street. And I looked at those animals around me and those animals walking toward me, and I looked into their eyes, and what I saw was nothing. What I saw was blindness. What I saw was the dead stare of the zombie. So The popular cultural meme of zombie apocalypse and zombies running around the planet is not just a Hollywood fantasy. It is an actual reality corresponding to what has happened to the human animal. When you blind the perceptual field of a human animal in this particular manner, and this is the main way it has been done, through photography and through faking. When you blind the human animal in that way, you not only destroy our discernment to tell the fake from the real, but you turn the human animal into a glassy-eyed zombie. And you can actually see this. You can see it. Just go to any major city and just sit there, stand there on the sidewalk and just look. These are human animals who can still see with their eyes, but they cannot perceive what they are seeing. And they have no judgment. They have no acumen. Matangi restores this acumen to us. She restores this power to the human animal. The first weapon that we must have is the weapon of human-animal acumen, the ability to perceive vividly and immediately the true nature of what you are actually seeing and what you are not seeing, to be able to perceive also what is omitted. So this brings me to another point about what is omitted. The idea that you can perceive something in the world from which something has been omitted, deliberately removed, but you cannot detect the omission. Try to get that idea into your mind. The idea is that there's something there that you should be seeing, but it has been omitted. And if you have the Matangi eye, you will perceive the omission. If you do not have the Matangi eye, you will not even realize that something has been omitted, and that is a serious, serious mistake. That being so, you can be controlled and manipulated to an extent that is inconceivable. So restoring this power is the first thing Matangi wishes to do, and it's the first thing she offers when you hold the sheath of her knife. She restores the power to see what has been omitted. Now, let me talk just for a moment about this theme of what has been omitted. Let's go back to the introduction of photography at the end of the 19th century. The technology of photography grew very rapidly, and so soon enough, in a matter of decades, many, many people were taking pictures. Many photographic devices were invented. I'm not even talking about the fantastic cameras that were invented at the beginning of the 20th century, but leading up to that, different types of cameras were invented, and the techniques for developing photographs rapidly advanced, and so forth and so on. Now let's focus on something for a moment. Let's focus on the subject matter of that early photography. There are many things that could have been photographed. Anything in the world could have been photographed. So certainly, photographs were made. Early photography shows us many photographs of people, either portrait photographs or people performing activities. And there was the military realized, of course, the value of photography from the very outset. So you have military photographs. That is a photograph, say, of a fortress on a hill. Then the soldiers who are required to storm that fortress can study the photograph and then they, when they make their assault, they are more prepared if the photograph is an accurate replica of the real place, and so forth and so on. But certainly one of the key uses, let me say, of photography was in criminal investigation. Because what could be better than photographs of scenes of the crime? Now, if there is a murder, if there is some crime, let's say that some people are shot in a restaurant, well, immediately upon the discovery of the crime, photographers arrive, the police photographers, and this became a vocation with the rise of photography. And their job is to photograph not only the whole scene exactly as it looks, but certain details, for instance, a bullet in a wall, a pattern of blood spatter. And, of course, the point is that the criminal photographer must supply photographs that are not faked or manipulated. So, again, there is no macula received from looking at the photograph of a crime scene if those photographs are simply recording what was actually there. They show you what you see were you to go there. And they have a great value because eventually the crime scene gets disturbed and something has to be done. But if detectives want to continue to research the crime, they have the photographic evidence of the crime. So I'm talking about photographic evidence of crimes. Now this is, by definition, photography that must not be in any way manipulated. Otherwise, the evidence is faked. So I'm talking now about genuine, unfaked photographic evidence of crimes. Now, needless to say, the job of photographing crimes was undertaken by many, many people with the rise of photography. And it became, and still is today, an important part of forensics, that is to say, the art of investigation, the art of gathering and evaluating evidence. That's what I call forensics. It's my definition. So you have forensic photography, okay. Medical photography is related to forensic photography. If someone at the crime scene takes a photograph of ligature marks on the neck of a victim, well, those marks will fade. Those marks will go away in the course of time. But if the photograph is taken within hours of the crime, then there is a photographic record of the way the victim was killed. And this is valuable. This can be used in court, and this can be used by detectives to seek to solve the crime. So, everybody knows what photographic evidence of crimes is. It's easy, isn't it? But let me ask you this question. Who looks at this evidence? Who gets to see this evidence? Well, generally speaking, I guess you could say that the photographers who take the pictures get to see it. They hand them over to the detectives. The police get to see it. Sometimes people related to the crime, witnesses or relatives of the victims, get to see it. But the public doesn't usually get to see it, do they? Now, I'm going to jump from that question. Just keep that question in your mind for a moment. There's a withholding. There's an omission of something here. Keep that question, keep that idea I'm developing in your mind for a moment. If you want to put it into a scenario, put it into this scenario. There, you are living in a house, and next door to your house, in your neighbor's house, there was a murder. Or you're told there was a murder. In fact, you're told that your neighbor was murdered and his dog was shot. There could be photographic evidence of that, showing your neighbor lying there shot and the dead dog, but you're not going to see it, are you? So consider this, that there is photographic evidence in the world that people in general are not allowed to see. That is what is being omitted. And why would that photographic evidence be kept from the public? There's another point that I want to make. All of this is a way that I am framing up a key element in Matangi's instruction about using her eye. Let me call your attention for a moment to some photographs of quite gruesome crimes that have been shown to the public. I'm thinking specifically of photographs of mafia hits. You know, during the 70s and 80s, I can remember, and even during the 60s, that there were mafia wars going on all over the United States at that time. There's some marvelous documentaries on them. You could spend a really enriching evening. Really, I'm being serious. Watching three or four documentaries about the Italian mafia, the Irish mafia, and so forth. Don't forget the Jewish mafia, the worst one of all. It's a little harder to find a documentary about them, but they do exist. But anyway, through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, those of us living in that period recall that you would see on television sometimes, a photograph would be presented on television, but you would also see in magazines and newspapers still photography of some mafia boss that had been assassinated in a war between competing families. And it was a big thing, and it's a big deal when some mafia boss who's sitting in a barber chair in Brooklyn gets basically his face blown open. It was a big deal, and it's, of course, of great interest. It's sensational. It's of greatest interest to the public, and it sells newspapers. So it would not be unusual to be in New York City in the 60s and see a full front cover page of one of the New York newspapers with a black and white photo of a mafia boss laying in the street. Usually they would have a sheet thrown over the body, but sometimes you could see a bloody arm, you could see the puddle of blood on the pavement. And this is not fake. This is an actual, genuine, undoctored photograph of someone who has been murdered. It is photographic evidence of a murder. But let me ask you this. Why did it happen that the public was allowed to see these photographs of mafia hits, usually of other mafia members, but they were not allowed to see other photographs of people being murdered? For instance, it could be that there was, or even of an accident. It could be that an accident happened, a horrible car accident. I arrive on the scene, I take photographs of the gruesome carnage of the bodies in these cars, and do I show that to the public? Well, I can't really. It's not allowed. There's some rule, it appears, that this is not allowed. Furthermore, look at what's happening today. Since 9/11, the United States of America and its NATO partners have been committing committing murder and carnage in Iraq on an inconceivable scale of murder. And how many still photographs of that have you ever seen in a magazine, in a newspaper? Now, you can see still photographs of children, dismembered children from Iraq. You can see them. If you want to go on the internet, you can find them. But this is a fairly recent development. It's a very good development, actually, as far as I'm concerned. But you will admit that it's only fairly recently that we as individuals have the opportunity to go and seek through a research device, that is to say, a computer with a screen, still photographs of actual carnage that is being committed on this planet, 724, on a scale of horror that is unimaginable. If you wish to look at some of that photographic evidence, you can go and find it. But it will never be shown on the American media, of course. It would never be shown. They would never show a dismembered Palestinian child, a boy who had been shot in the back by an Israeli soldier. They would never show a photograph of that boy, an actual photographic evidence, undoctored, on mainstream media, would they? So you see, we're getting into a territory that is really familiar. We in the Western world and in the whole planet in general live in an environment saturated with imagery. Even if we just take still photography, disregarding all the rest, you have to admit that we're inundated and we're saturated with this imagery. But when you look at this imagery with the Matangi eye, you have to ask this question. What am I not seeing? What am I not allowed to see? And why am I not allowed to see it? I came to realize almost immediately, with the instruction that came with Matangi's gift or knife, I came to realize something that is so painfully obvious that it seems incredible that no one has ever questioned it. And this is a sensation that often happens when you're using the Matangi eye. I would alert you to that. I would alert you to that impression. You're suddenly seeing something that is so painfully obvious that you are simultaneously baffled that no one has ever pointed it out before. As I said, where is the network and affiliate footage of the motorcade on the day of the JFK assassination? And even if the network film teams were not at Dealey Plaza filming the motorcade's passage through the plaza, even if they weren't, which seems highly improbable and highly unlikely, since they were there at the airport, they were there at the breakfast talk, they were there at the beginning of the motorcade, why weren't they there when the car turned the turn into Dealey Plaza? Okay, even if they weren't there, why hasn't anybody asked why they weren't there? It's so painfully obvious that there must have been network footage that showed this assassination taking place. And yet, through all the years and all the investigations, I've never heard anyone ask that question. It's not the question itself specific to that event that is so important. It's worth thinking about and worth pondering, certainly. But rather than the question specific to that event, take a few steps back and look at the question in the abstract. It's the question in the abstract that you want to hold in your mind to hold steady with the Matangi eye. And the question in the abstract goes like this. How does it happen that there is an unwritten rule that determines what photographic evidence can be shown to the public at large and what photographic evidence must be omitted, must be withheld? It's like there is a rule. And people follow this rule. Well, first of all, who made this rule? Let me give you an example applicable to the Sandy Hook event. I'm jumping now between the JFK event and the Sandy Hook event. They are both illustrations of acquiring the Matangi eye. I would say this. Some people have questioned if 20 or so children were actually killed in those classrooms. Of course, this is crazy-making to question, but on the other hand, maybe it isn't. Well, I put it to the world this way. If 20 or so children were brutally massacred by a shower of bullets in those classrooms, show me the pictures of these children. Show me the pictures of 6-year-old, 7-year-old boys and girls with their bodies blown apart and their faces blown open. Show me those photographs. I want to see them. Now, it could be said, oh, no. There is an unspoken rule that these photographs would not be shown to the public and that would not be available for distribution so that anyone could see them. Out of respect for the children and out of respect for the parents. You've probably had that notion pop up in your head. That's a kind of a rule. Well, who made up that rule? And who enforces that rule? There is a rule on this planet concerning how human beings who invented still photography can use the products of that invention. And I'm saying to you that that rule is not of a human origin. It's impossible for that rule to be strictly of a human origin, because it is impossible that there could be such a massive orchestration and control of these photographic artifacts. There must be some kind of rule operating in the human mind, as well as external enforcement. Of course, there is external enforcement operating. For instance, if you don't see a picture of a Palestinian child with its body blown apart, as happens on a daily basis in Israel, on television or in a magazine or a newspaper in the United States, it's because of control of the media by the Zionist faction, obviously. The Zionist Israeli mafia, obviously. They have that degree of control. But I put it to you that they could not exercise that degree of control if there was not some other kind of rule operating in the human mind itself that causes people to comply with that control. I use the word rule over and over again. And may it remind you that the word archon in Gnostic writings can be translated as rulers or authorities. Who are rulers? They are those who make the rules. So there is a kind of archontic rule operating in your own mind that would make you, A, complicit in withholding this photographic evidence, if you had the evidence, if you were someone who had it, who handled it. Or if not, B, make you complicit or make you a consenting person in the agreement not to look at that photographic evidence or not to present that photographic evidence. There's a rule, and this rule is a fixture in the human subconscious through which a great deal of evil and manipulation is achieved. One of the actions of Matangi's knife is to cut this rule, to cut it and break it away. And I consider this rule to be something like a hook. In fact, I'm even going to do a play on words, and I'm going to say that it is a silicon hook, a sandy hook. What is the Sandy Hook? It is a silicon hook, which is a hook that the Archons have lowered into the human subconscious. And they have caught the human animal on this hook. And then they pull the human animal on a string connected to this hook to become free of the archontic power. We'll have to take this hook out of your flesh or just use the knife and cut the line, and then you can take the hook out later or it will fall out. But you cannot take the hook out of your flesh, out of your subconscious, while the Archons are pulling you by the hook, the silicon hook. So the first use of the knife is to cut the line. How do you cut the line? You focus on the question. Matangi uses questions as devices for forensic investigation. Concentrate on the question. How does it happen that there is an unwritten, unspoken rule about releasing photographic evidence to the public at large? Now, you might think I'm making a big deal out of something that is obvious and simple. It's obvious that the police or the detectives or the authorities who hold these photographs do not consider them to be public fare. They're evidence that is being used for the investigations they're undertaking. In those cases where the investigations concern gruesome crimes, they consider it a service to the public, not to subject the public to looking at photographs of these gruesome events. But I say, show me. Show me real photographs of real gruesome events. I want to see them. And I really want to see photographs of the murdered children in Sandy Hook. Don't you? I want to see the photographs of the killer dead. I want to see the photographs of the door he broke into. I want to see the photographs of the chaos in the schoolrooms, the bullet holes on the wall. I want to see all of that, and I would like to know why the citizens of this world cannot see those photographs. Because the stunning effect of the Sandy Hook PSYOP is that it forces you to accept the omission of evidence when your mind is screaming to see the evidence. And the message of the Sandy Hook event is the message intended to produce despair in the human mind. Horrible things are being done around you. Eventually they will be done to you, and no one will ever be able to see them being done. This is the message of Sandy Hook. This is the terrible message. One of the terrible messages transmitted by that PSYOP, which was, by the way, I must say, I have to hand it to them, it was incredibly brilliant PSYOP. You know, Sandy Hook is an advance beyond 9/11, and I'll tell you exactly what kind of advance it was, kind of advance it is. With 9/11, as many people now know, there was an event that took place that was not what it appeared to be. There was a narrative that went along with the event, and then there was the cover-up of the event, which was contained in the narrative. So when you look at 9/11, and this is another exercise Matangi requires, we see the event, the physical event of what actually happened. We realize there was a physical event. There was a narrative attached to that event, and then there was the cover-up operating in the narrative. What is so brilliant about Sandy Hook, hold on, folks, what is so brilliant and so advanced about this evil, evil deed of deceit is that there was no event. The event is the cover-up. And the cover-up is fantastically deceitful because it covers up something that didn't happen. Not saying that those were not real children and that they have not disappeared, but I'm asking you to consider an alternative that is even more horrific than the thought of them being murdered in that classroom. And that is that they were not murdered, but they were taken away by someone to have something else done to them. So you see, this is the extent of evil. We are into it up to our knees in the sludge of evil on this planet. And the Sandy Hook event is a brilliant psyop, calculated and orchestrated in such a way that the Sandy Hook event is the cover-up, and the cover-up covers an event that didn't happen. That is why you will never see any photographic evidence from that event. And those who orchestrated that event are telling you that in your face. It even comes in the demented, grotesque performance of the coroner, who laughs and says, "Well, you can do anything with good photography, and I have a great team of photographers." Why did he say that? Why was he allowed or directed to say those exact words? "You can do anything with good photography, and I have a great team of photographers." Matangi asks you to consider those words actually said by that man on that scene and broadcast across this entire planet. And Matangi asks you to consider why on earth, A, he would say such a thing, and B, it would be allowed to be broadcast. That is revelation of the method. Many things are coming now in the Dakini instruction from Matangi. She is the first of Gaia's infernal handmaidens to train us and equip us for the magical war. The first weapons come from Matangi. And she has specific instructions about this mysterious matter called revelation of the method. As her instruction unfolds, and it's unfolding rapidly, you have the opportunity to know what is revelation of the method, which is just a term that I can attach to the working of diabolical deceit in the human mind. The working of the murderous and dissembling magic of Mephisto. At this point, I advise you to go to YouTube and type in the YouTube search bar, "Dr. Judy Wood by Anne Hess," A-N-N-E-H-E-S-S. This is the title attached to a 34-minute clip of that was originally or initially published, I think, at the end of November 2012. It presents Dr. Judy Wood speaking at the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference in Hilversum, wherever that is. And she is interviewed by a woman named Anne Hess, a Norwegian investigative journalist. I advise you to go and look at this and listen closely to this interview, which has some features that I have not found in other talks by Judy Wood. As you know, I respect Dr. Wood, and I do follow her analysis of the evidence. It's interesting that Judy Wood uses photographic evidence in her book, Where Did the Towers Go? You find that she solved the crime of 9/11 in one respect as to what was done, not necessarily who did it, although she certainly pointed in that direction as well. But she solved the crime by using the technology or the artifacts of the technology of still photography. And she investigated and examined meticulously tens of thousands of photographs. She was not on the scene when it happened. She was there not too long afterwards. She gathered the photographic evidence, and the photographic evidence Dr. Judy Wood used does not produce macula because it is simply accurate, undoctored, unfaked replications of events and scenes at the crime site. I would point out that at the beginning of this interview, it's a dynamite interview, it's remarkable that at the beginning of this interview, at minute 1:26, Anne Hess puts this question to Dr. Judy Wood. What did we see in the 9/11 event that we did not see? And this is the question that inaugurates this interview, a most significant question. You would recognize this is really the Matonge question. What did we see at 9/11 that we did not see? That is to say, it's a double omission. There is that which we did not see because we were not allowed to see it, because the photography was tricked, because the appearances of the day were tricked. Or we were not allowed to see it because the photographic evidence was removed. In the case, for instance, of 30 to 40 closed-circuit television cameras filming the Pentagon, and yet there is not one convincing, authentic, undoctored image of an object hitting the Pentagon, is there? In another sense, what did we see that we did not see? The omission is not due to the withholding and manipulation of the photographic evidence, but the omission is due to the blinding of our perceptual capacities. At the moment the 9/11 events were unfolding, in the traumatic state of observation, our faculties of perception were blinded. And that blindness was exacerbated by the false narrative that was laid on the events and exacerbated again and again by false witnessing, by fake witnesses, and by the manipulation of reports, by the manipulation of the reports of eyewitnesses. There were eyewitnesses reports at 9/11 that there were many of them that contradicted the official narrative, and those reports were either manipulated or eliminated. Likewise, for the event of the Kennedy assassination, there were over 50 eyewitness reports of a shooter on the grassy knoll, and those 50 people all went to the authorities. They all went to the FBI and filed reports of what they saw. Not one single report of an eyewitness of a shooter on the grassy knoll was included in the official investigation. Again, it was omitted. This act of omission is a key to the method of the trickster and of those enemies of humanity who are under the spell of the trickster and who are enacting his agenda, as it were, the agenda of Mephisto, which is an interesting subject. I suppose that's where I would be going from here, and that would be a good subject for the third talk along these lines. So in concluding, let me see if I can refocus on the main point here. There is no way to affect life on this planet for the better, and no way to participate intimately in Sophia's solution for humanity without undertaking some role in the war against the adversary. And the magical weapons for executing that war, for fighting that war in defense of all that lives, are weapons, are tools of power and tools of knowledge. It is the supernatural, the Nahual of the wisdom goddess, that actually provides these tools to you. It's not me. You can receive these tools directly, or you can receive them by way of my instruction and commentary. And bear in mind, as you stand there on the firing line with those three goddesses in front of you, bear in mind that the greatest weapon of all, the greatest weapon of the Anthropos, is the beauty of her story. The beauty of the story of the Aeon Sophia is so immense, so powerful, that the disclosure of that story is the greatest single threat to the predators and psychopaths on this planet. Isn't that clear by now? I dearly wish that what I'm saying should be painfully obvious to you. Why did the Gnostics have to be eliminated, and why were they eliminated in such a brutal manner over so many centuries? And why was the elimination of the Gnostics and the mystery schools carried forward into the witch craze of the Middle Ages and into the murder of untold millions of men and women in Europe who were simply following practices that aligned them with the powers of nature? Because the beauty of her story and the beauty of the magic endowments that come through loving her and bonding with her in the natural world is the greatest weapon on this planet. That is our weapon. Her beauty. And with her beauty comes the revelation of her method. So Vivi is also instructing the Kalika parties in this war. Matangi teaches us to see revelation of the method as it is used by the diabolical adversaries. Vivi teaches the revelation of her method, and that is the use of beauty and the sacred application of violence in both magical and non-magical expressions.